This is Dig and Swing, a volleyball podcast for everyday coaches. Okay, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Dig and Swing. This week, I have my beardy co-host, not disposable anymore. You have been promoted, Pat. So my beardy, Bodie McBoatface co-host, Pat Medea, is with us today.
Hello, Pat. Everybody.
Hello, everybody. And then we have two awesome guests today. Alex Brodzewski. I totally messed that up, but it was close enough. And Tim Doyle. They have this really great, I guess it's more of like a research project-ish research article about, in the most layman's terms. It's called Engineering Winning Volleyball. And the way I took it is it's kind of talks about getting back into volleyball safely. And Pat knows you guys, right, Pat? Unfortunately.
The detriment of all of us.
And so, Pat, do you want to kind of like give them a little introduction and talk about, and they can talk about what they're up to?
Well, I believe it would just be easier to have the William and Mary staff talk about what they did first.
But, let's do it.
This is essentially a return to play policy because COVID has basically nuked all athletics. And there is a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this. So why not go with science to guide us? Novel concept. So I don't know if it's easier for Tim to talk first or for Alex, but I'll let you guys take that away.
I'll start. So first of all, thanks for having us both on and giving us the opportunity to just kind of talk this through and be on your platform. Pretty cool to be here. I'm really excited for it. So it's definitely a return to play. I think it started more like what is the game of volleyball? Coming from the question from our leader of high performance and was asking me a bunch of semantic questions about volleyball, like what's your average rally length and how many jumps are your girls taking? I'm like, I don't know. I'm a Division I head coach and I really should probably know like really specific information like this. And so that actually just kicked off a project to kind of understand our game better, especially with the fact that volleyball has become way more popular in the past decade. I felt like it was time to maybe just professionalize the approach to the game. And out of that, you know, we started to track jumps and swings and a bunch of data. And basically, COVID actually coincided and dovetailed with the project because at that point, we had a bunch of information about what the game of volleyball actually, you know, constituted. And from there, you know, that's where Alex came in. He can talk about his role, but from there, it became a return to play and figuring out exactly how to scale after coming back from, you know, 20 plus weeks of inactivity. How do you get back in the gym? How do you do it safely? How do you scale appropriately? And all that kind of just came out of trying to understand our game better. So that's where it started. And then Alex came in and really just geeked it up a little bit and took my level of understanding of the nuances of sport training and just, I mean, just took it through the roof for me. So, yeah.
And where you coach where?
Sorry. Yeah. William and Mary. I'll be starting year three prior to William and Mary. I was at VCU for 4 years and we did okay there. And then I actually went to VCU after being at Ohio State on the men's side. So transitioned from the men's game to the women's game and just love it. So William and Mary is awesome. And that's where we met Alex too.
So I got plugged into this project after Tim and as well as five other schools collected data on the sport of volleyball. And then COVID obviously has increased the stakes on return to play by a lot. Most schools don't need to deal with a inordinately long voluntary training period beforehand, or younger teams just don't even need to deal with it at all. Like with the example of club, which I'm currently at William & Mary now as a performance staff member. But prior to that, about 6 months ago, I was wrapping up my tenure at Northern Lights Junior Volleyball. So I'm familiar with both club and part of the Division I space, at least the offseason space right now. Also working at Concordia St. Paul for the previous 2 years where I helped with volleyball, but let the head guy take care of the programming for it. But most places don't need to navigate a long voluntary training space beforehand. Whereas now everybody does. So with that in mind, we took research from other sports, rugby, cricket, bowlers, as well as Australian rules football, since there's a lot of sports science done in those fields, as well as Premier League soccer, Premier League football, and all of the articles, of course, because it's overseas. But since there's a lot of money in those, managing the workloads of incredibly expensive players was something that was of interest, so they wrote papers on it. But the rules still apply to other sports as well. So taking what we knew from the study that Tim coordinated last fall, taking those numbers and putting them into the things that we know about the human body and how it responds to training, and trying to put us in a position where we can limit the amount of risk that we expose our athletes to and limit the amount that they get hurt coming back from a long way off is really the goal and the outcome. And what we've put together says, one, it's a problem that we come back and do too much. And then if we're going to present a problem, we should probably present a solution. So the way I took my
layman's summary was, you must balance practice demands without overuse and maintain power without injury. And then I said, this is especially important when athletes have been inactive for months due to COVID. And I think it's important in general. Would you say that's pretty accurate summary, easy summary?
Yeah.
Would you be, Alex, would you be willing to kind of walk us through from the strength side, the different return to play policies, like that you, in the documents, you have like a 2 week, a 4 week and a 6 week, and kind of break down from a strength side, what would work and what won't, and kind of the why behind all of it.
So as far as like physical prep or just the training load aspect of things?
I guess both, because they kind of intertwine the entire time.
So for the things that Pat's referring to, there at the end of the document, whether you have the long one or the short one, there's three different models of how to return to play, all of them written in mind of trying to start week one with as low of training load as possible. So the 2 week one had to be written differently than the 6 week one because it sped up, but we're also trying to keep the training sessions low enough where it's not a scary week one to go from zero to doing that amount of work. That, like I kind of touched on earlier, the lot of risk involved of going from zero to whatever it is. And about 75% of injuries in volleyball come from practice after a unsupervised or limited training period. So having the lowest entry level possible is really the goal, because that will ideally limit the amount of risk that we're exposing to. Whereas I think everyone listening can hopefully agree that showing up day one and playing five sets and then taking an hour off and playing another five sets is probably not the move, but then taking the data that we've put together and then building to where we got to go. So from a strength and conditioning standpoint, hopefully you have a strength and conditioning practitioner available to you that can guide you on this. So I'm not going to touch on it too much, but if you're a sport coach doing non-volleyball things on the court, as far as conditioning goes, keep it easy, keep it mobility wise, just things that make them feel better rather than trying to bury them with volume. Let the sport be the primary stimulus during any of these models, because at this point we've got a not long period of time to get ready. The benefit of being at a Division I school with funding, like, and under traditional circumstances, teams would start in June with their strength coach and be able to build a large chronic training load. So then when they hop into training camp, it's not as big of an issue. Clearly we don't have that issue, and stress is stress. So in this case, the specific stress is the most important, because we got to play the volleyball, and if they're exposed to the specific stress, they'll be less likely to get injured by that stress, if that makes sense. So be willing to, from the strength side, be willing to take a step back and realize that it's really not that important to play volleyball in 4 weeks, and do things that help the performance of the actual sport. We're not trying to develop a whole lot of strength this period of time. So the 6 weeks, because we have a longer ramp, we're able to start lower. It's the least risky of them because the front end is the lowest amount of work. 4 week is essentially the same model, but it starts off a little bit higher. And then the 2 week will be four high days a week, so that the higher training stress is spread out a little bit more throughout the week.
What does that look like basically same question to you, but how does that transfer onto the court and how we would run practices and load a practice?
Yeah.
Before we get a 6 week.
Because
obviously different areas will have different return to play policies. Like that, I'm sure there'll be some high schools that will just go right back to, hey, your tryouts and 2 weeks later, you can go right into play. And some areas may have a bit longer of an off season to work with.
Yeah. And that's, that's part of it is if you're working on a 2 week schedule, for instance, and I think a majority of the country is accustomed to a 2 week preseason training plan, whether it's high school or, I mean, even at the Division I level, some schools can't get in until 2.5 weeks before the first match. So the reality is, though, that a lot of time, the first 3 weeks of an athlete coming back into preseason training are the most vulnerable. The first 7 days are especially so, especially at risk for injury. And a lot of times the first thing that coaches do when they get their athletes in the gym is, we're going to go twice a day for 2 hours every day for 2 weeks, and we are going to be prepped and we're going to be ready to go. And this document basically is like, listen, that's the wrong approach. I mean, we know that just absolutely spiking, if you're practicing with that amount of volume, you're going to put your kids at risk. So really what the idea is, start conservative. We're not looking at 2-a-days. We're looking at maybe, you go hard for one day and the next day is maybe an off day, or maybe something just as simple as a 30-minute serve and pass. And then the next day you can kind of go hard again, followed by an off day or a low serve and pass. You have this kind of high, low model that we read about. I think the best way for me to, I always think cross sport. And I don't know if anybody here played basketball growing up or has ever tried to play even pickup basketball, but it's like you get back. I play like little, poor man's basketball or just little staff hoops or something. And you play once and you're just dead beat from like an hour of it. Right. Imagine doing that and then doing it again later in the day and you're super sore the next day. And then you do it again twice. You're even more sore than 48 hours after that. You do it again. And then at the end of that, what do? You play the most important pickup basketball game that you're going to play yet, which is the actual match. And that's the idea, is like, we don't want to burn them out in that 2 week span. So what does it look like when you start to program training? It looks like, hey, let's go hard for a day. Let's take a day off. And when you do go hard, that doesn't mean twice in the same day. Ideally what you're looking at, and the general rule of thumb for any coach out there, if they could take one thing away about where do I start in week one and be, what does your competition week look like? Maybe you play twice and you have a couple of practices, take 50% of like what your team would do in that week. And that's where you should start. And that's a general rule of thumb. And obviously if you did that, it wouldn't result in two practices a day, every single day with no rest period in between, no opportunity to recover and no way to get better. And I know that the temptation is like, we need to tactically prepare. We need to teach the system. But at that point, you're not going to get it all done anyways. And you're either working with athletes who are semi-broken at that point or just dog tired and can't execute the tactics that you want them to. Or you continue to just try and, like Alex mentioned, you train with the competitions kind of become the stimulus at that point. And there's a little bit of training through the games in the very beginning, but eventually you can build to it and start to do more practice too.
So with that said, what you're trying to say is we don't win a championship week one.
I do. What are you talking about?
We don't. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to balance because you also don't want to. You're weighing the morale of the team. You're weighing the expectations of your administration or your athletic directors, and you don't want to start 0-6. But listen, you also don't want to start 6-0 and having tapped out all of your potential, and then you're plagued by injuries the rest of the season. Then maybe you have a couple kids get some, traumatic injury, and then you lose a conference championship because that's ultimately what your contract is based off of. Or that's what, at the end of the year, that's what everybody's playing for, is the championship. So it's tough to weigh, because in the beginning, you're so excited to get back after it. You're so excited to get in the gym and train and go hard. And it's really tough to kind of pull the gear back on that and downshift a little bit. But if you can understand the fact that this is the best thing for the student athlete, this is the best thing for their body, it's the best thing for your team. And ultimately, and a lot of the studies that, Alex mentioned, or the sectors that Alex mentioned, whether it's Australian rules rugby or Qatari football, it leads to winning. less injury leads to winning. Hello. So let's not overthink that. Like, if you're going hard all the time, every day, and you get more injured, this isn't an, like an opinion. You don't have a bigger roster because kids are now not on that roster. You can't suddenly just produce or generate talent from there. So the idea is you want to keep the kids healthy, and that's what our job is. And then our job is also to win, and you're going to do that with healthy kids.
If you, from a club perspective, if you show up with a full roster at Nationals and you can play everybody and you can play 4 days, by day four, you'll have a fresher team than if you had to play six the whole time, right? So, yeah. Or practice bodies, or just at the college level, if you're healthy, you're going to end up getting more reps in the long run than if you go ridiculously hard week one and lose everybody. And then you'll have six players that have to play every rep, so they're going to be more tired in the sets that count. Not going to win as many points. And the percentage of the amount of time that they'll actually be in a position to learn the skills is going to be lower anyway. So it's the marshmallow test. Do you sit and look at a marshmallow for a couple weeks and not snag the marshmallow? Or do you take the marshmallow now and then not get any later?
And I think with that said, the big, the prevailing thought, and it's written in the study, and I'm going to probably butcher the term, but going hard, like the idea of character building, conditioning, is detriment. I forget how you guys worded it, but it was detrimental to overall team success. And I was like, oh, someone actually wrote it in black and white finally. This very antiquated thought of, you know, you build character by running gassers or whatever. How much is that actually addressed in there? And if you want to expound upon that, because I read that, and I was just like, thank you. It's been of my opinion this is stupid, but when someone actually has college degrees that would suggest statistical proof, like, no, this is actually stupid, that's kind of cool.
One of our Dr. Corum, who is listed at the front end of being the inspiration of all of this and getting Tim to look into how long a rally is and all of those sorts of things, is if you want to look into a Twitter feed that's all about this, Dr. Eric Corum is somebody to look into. But he's about the fact that mental toughness is task specific. So if we put a Navy SEAL into a national title volleyball match, they're going to crack. Or fourth and one in the Super Bowl, they're going to crack because it's task specific. But for what they're asked to do as special forces operators, they're tougher than anyone else on the planet. So the fact that you'll run somebody through a conditioning test and they succeed at it doesn't mean that they're going to be mentally tough enough to get the serve in and the state championship point, for example. So doing things that are hard to develop toughness isn't really, it's just not a thing. It's more, you'll see who the tough kids are who are willing to be disciplined enough to finish things out, but you'll usually know that on the front end anyway. You can probably pick out the kid on your team that's mentally tough enough or disciplined enough to get it done regardless of the situation.
Not to mention, again, if it goes back to like, if you're just wearing your kids out, what's really, it can hurt mentally as an athlete is, Pat, like when you play volleyball and you know what you're capable of, and then you severely underperform because you're tired or you can't jump or you're not hitting your altitude, you're not, that first step feels slow because you're just plagued by fatigue. That's also has that's a detrimental effect too to performance. So if we're trying to maximize, and then you look at across sport, I mean, I guarantee you, if you looked at, like Steph Curry and said, yo, like what's your optimal training routine? I doubt he's going to say, I go hard every day. I try and burn out. He's going to say, I optimally try and recover. You see these Olympic swimmers and Olympic athletes where they have recovery tents that they put over their bed just to recover optimally and with adequate time. And so the idea that, and those are some of the mentally toughest athletes in the world at their sport. And yes, they've gotten good at it, which is the task specificity that Alex is referring to, but it's also just a smart way to do things. And if the pros are doing it, why aren't we doing it? Why are we not allowing time for our athletes to recover so that they can then perform and get better? Idea that they stair-step success means that they have to have time to continue to build on that. And you can't build on it when that foundation is continually eroded by fatigue. Again, looking at the top athletes, I mean, I'm guessing that they would say they need to recover so that they can get better the next day and better the next day. And so that's part of the equation. And through doing that, you start to perform better. And what happens when you perform better? You're more confident. A lot of people might associate confidence with mental toughness. And I think you have to start with how mental toughness is probably defined. You know, because it means a lot. It doesn't mean that you can withstand some brutal gasser drill. That's not mental toughness. Maybe it's sturdiness. Maybe you're just really good at taking some suck. But it doesn't mean that you're any better at your sport mentally tougher when it's 24-24 and you need the finesse touch of a serve receive and you need to be explosive and jump up and snap a ball to win the point. You know, that comes from continuing to get better at your training and more explosive through smart training.
I know what you're talking about, Pat, in that section. I sent Pat like my kind of talking points of the things that I analyzed from the project. And I have in highlight lots of clapping from me, bold lettering. And I took like a screenshot of you talking about this, about how people think that this consecutive training of really hard practices going hard is building mental toughness. And it's one of those things that people, it's almost like, it's like a theater. It's a show. It shows, you know, if a parent's walking by in a gym and sees a club doing this, they go, oh, they must be working really hard. They must be, you know, really great. And really you don't realize that, you know, so-and-so has had jumper's knee for 3 months and can barely move without being in excruciating pain. And, you know, they're doing it at the expense of players' physical health, but also the mental health part. One of the things I wanted to ask was, I love your data about the number of jumps and the average length of rallies. I am a data nerd. I do accounting work, so I love numbers. And I've never thought about how long a rally is and how I make my drills around that. But I do want to go first into the internal load part. I think that this is something that is usually underrated. I don't think a lot of coaches really think about the internal load part. And for those that don't know, it's the internal load is, you know, I kind of call it like the, you know, the intangibles, like the non-physical things that kind of bug you, you know, if you're having the physio and psychological stress of the day, the everyday stuff. And I'm wondering if not only due to COVID, but also, you know, I'm wondering if this is going to start bringing the importance of internal load a little bit more. Do you think that maybe that'll have an impact now? Now coaches are going to really be thinking about that. I don't know if that was actually a question, but more of a thought, I guess.
From the athletic performance side, short thought, boy, I hope so. That'd be super cool. Make my job a lot easier.
Right.
And I think too, I mean, there will be, everything's going to be a spectrum everything's a spectrum anyway. There will be the kids who internally load, they're free. They're just so excited to be back in the gym. Like I can name kids from the Northern Lights gym who will just walk in like a box of puppies. Just everything's, you know, sunshine and rainbows and oh my God, we get to play volleyball again. And then there's going to be the kids who after they try to serve for the first time and it's not exactly how it was the last time they were in the gym 11,000 weeks ago, it's going to be, oh God, I suck. And then they might've walked in super happy and then suddenly
reality hits.
Yeah. Like a ton of bricks. So,
Pat, what you're talking about is one of the things that we touch on is the fact that, when you exceed, like when you haven't done a certain level of activity and for a while and you jump immediately back into it, and then you blow it up beyond that. Not only are you at risk for that week, you're actually at an elevated, one of the research studies said 2 to 4 times elevated risk from normal risk in the week after that week. So we're not even saying, okay, you're in peril that week, but we're talking about the weeks after. So what happens if you're in jeopardy the week after and you still keep doing the same thing? This just compounds one on the other. And so then you're just dealing with the wrong hand. And the idea is what behind internal load is that's kind of your response to training. How is the athlete responding to their training? Are they fit enough or are they more fit? Are they more prepared? Are they better trained or are they not? When you don't allow time for recovery, the performance improvement comes in the space of recovery time. The performance improvement does not come when you multiple, when you layer on training after training after training after training. It doesn't come from a volume amount of training sessions. It comes from go hard, take a day off, go hard, take a day off, go hard. And you allow that time. It'd be like if I was lifting weights and I tried to lift 50s on day one with dumbbell press. And then I tried 60s the next day and then 70s the day after that. It doesn't work like that. You have to take a day off. You have to eat, you have to recover and sleep. And you have to manage the other stressors, which that's a big part of all of our athletes. The relationships, my God, especially for teenagers, relationships, family, homework, being away from home, like the stress of the minor minutia that we maybe as more mature people think is minutia is the biggest deal. Like that was for me as a teenager, I'm thinking the smallest things are actually the biggest deal about somebody not responding to my text. Like if you continue to elevate training every single day, that compounds in addition to the other stressors. That's a real mile mark for like a waypoint that says you're going in the wrong direction of somebody breaking, of somebody becoming so beat down from physical training and the mental, like you touched on, Sarah. It's yeah, I could go forever about that. But the idea is go hard, take a day off, go hard. And the training prescriptions in the study go a little bit more into depth about, you know, how long should a practice be, about how hard should a practice be. And we use the RPE scale, which measures intensity, or rate of perceived exertion is what it stands for. Basically, you ask your athletes after practice, how hard was practice? And they give you a number and you multiply that by the duration of practice. And that whole number, that whole global load, as we call it, that's kind of those are the different things that you're tracking. And that's what the return to play procedures and schedules provide, is kind of the day-to-day of that. So hopefully that helps, you know, people as they try and say, well, what is good load management? Hopefully that helps provide some guidance.
Pat,
please. I agree. I got nothing. Tim's really smart. No. And I think that's, I'm sure there are folks who, and I mean, no one comes out of the womb, you know, or starts coaching knowing about load management or what any of that stuff means. So I implore, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, go back and find these documents, read them, understand them, do some Googling on your own. 'Cause this is the stuff that separates like the coaches who can win a match to those who are successful. Because if you can save a kid's ACL, like that goes a long way for her career, like a really, really long way for her career. And I mean, just that team's success that season, because everyone's important. I mean, try running a practice with 9 kids, like I had to all year last year. It sucks. So, I mean, just it's one of those things that it matters so much more than what you think. And just because you got this far, I think, I mean, everything we're going to talk about really circles back to just because that's how you've always done it doesn't mean it's correct.
Yep.
And I'm so fired up right now by you talking about that, because
keep talking.
Say it again for the people in the back.
You know, we incurred 2 ACL injuries last year. One was, I think, about 2.5 weeks into the season. And then the other came about 5 weeks into the season. And I'm not saying that we trained in a way that produced those injuries. But when I reflected on it, I thought to myself, did I do everything in my power as head coach to mitigate the risk of injury to my athlete? And the answer was no. And there's nothing, no more powerful motivator then when you have to look in the mirror and say, I don't know enough about my own sport and about the proper loading of my athletes to properly mitigate the risk of injury that may or may not have influenced them suffering such a terrible thing.
If I could jump in right there, and it's not like anyone's got a drill in their drill book that says this is the ACL snapping. We don't have the ACL snapping drill. Like, it's not like anyone goes out intentionally. Like, I'm going to put my, like, okay, we're going to go play Frogger blindfolded on the highway. Like, we're not doing that at practice. But it's just how we design a practice and then, you know, design a singular practice and then that practice within the week, that week within the other weeks. is what will ultimately grind a kid's ACL or shoulder or back or hip or pick a body part, Alex.
Things happen. I mean, things do happen, but we're talking about risk mitigation and trying to, and at the end of the day, if you're a coach in a gym with athletes, you know, as a head coach, the buck stops with me. And so if I'm not well aware of all the things that go into training volleyball, whether it's external, internal load, if I don't know about that, shame on me, you know, because I need to educate myself. If I'm really, if I can't, at the end of the day, if those kids got injured, I'm not going to go to Alex and say, yo, you messed up, bro. No, guess what? The wins and losses go to my name. And so, you know what, if that's the case, then I need to manage all aspects of that. And any coach who has any training influence on their gym, in my opinion, needs to have that level of accountability. And that means understanding the things that go into it. And if you understand the things that go into it, I'll tell you what shouldn't go into it. 2 practices every day for 7 days a week for 2.5 weeks straight. And then you play some matches and have even more load on top of that.
So like if Alex saw you doing like having kids like jump off of boxes and try to jump and hit a ball, like he'd probably kick you out of your own gym.
Oh gosh.
Think I'm dumb. He'd be like, dude, have you run anything? You may actually be a rock.
Here's a book.
Yeah, so for you to throw at me.
Yeah. Well, one, for all the strength professionals out there that listen to Tim, not immediately blame me for any injuries occurring on his team. Say, I do really enjoy working with William and Mary. Because I wish that was normal. But I mean, I would say for anybody that's afraid, is like, well, we're not going to be able to install everything. And it's like, well, yeah, but then everybody's going to be there. And the amount, from my side of things, the seeing uninterrupted skill development for, like, if you start with a 9-year-old and they never get hurt and they never need to miss practice, even if it's 75% of what your normal practice is, that you never get to get as high in a single day, but they go uninterrupted for 12 years, they're going to get really good at volleyball by comparison to the person that has to take a year off because of a meniscus or an ACL. So managing your training load better, even if hypothetically it means that you have to do less, which it doesn't, but even if hypothetically you have to do less, then it being uninterrupted for a long period of time is going to result in a better athlete anyway. And if we install it intelligently, which we've laid out with the high-low model, you can maintain the same amount of training load, implement it intelligently, and have less injuries than you would otherwise.
And I think to make not a cross sport comparison, but just a comparison from another sector of the world, there's one of the Ferraris they just made. If you drive it at max speed, it will run out of gas in 8 minutes. Whereas you can get some, like one of those little egg cars that you could probably drive for 4 days without having to put more gas in it. So, I mean, I think having the end in mind of just like, yeah, we went 230 miles an hour for 8 minutes, and that's super cool. Like, don't get me wrong, it's super fun. You're out of gas now. And guess what? You had a whole season ahead of you. So, especially like once you get to like fifth, like upper level 15s and basically all of 16s and up, they already know how to play volleyball. I mean, if you're coaching a 12s team, like, okay, there's going to be problems. I get it. They're not good at volleyball yet.
But it's not finding gravity.
Yeah. We've gone through that. So, but I mean, like the girls at William and Mary, it's like they didn't forget how to play. Like there's a level of trust you can have with your athletes. We're like, yeah, we want to install some stuff. But if, like, let's just say in a week and a half, they had to play a match, it's not like they're going to interlock their fingers on serve receive and just like, oh my God, I don't know how to do anything.
Hey, and guess what? Whatever you thought you were installing in that week and a half, odds are they're going to look like crap doing it anyways, because they've only had a little bit of time to train it.
I really, I started thinking about beyond like the return to play beyond COVID, but just kind of in the day-to-day things that we do. And one of the things that I thought about was, are we properly preparing athletes for the demand of the game to avoid injury? And some of the things that I have witnessed, seen, heard, read about, you know, kind of make me, I automatically started thinking of them when I was reading your article about the number of jumps in our warmups, the number of jumps in a set, the number of jumps in a number of swings. Are we having them run a 10K the day before a tournament? Are we doing plyo training before a jump heavy practice? Are we jumping on heavy boxes and then jumping back down? And, you know, are we making sure that these activities that we're doing are appropriate? And I totally agree with you, Tim, about how you're like, shame on me, I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't even know how long an average rally was. I kind of just guessed. And it's kind of like, it was really eye-opening to think about that and some of the things that I've seen that now I'm like, oh, that probably wasn't that great of an idea. And so I think that this is applicable to beginners and experienced coaches. Like, you really do, this is a really great opportunity for people to take a step back and look at their training loads, whether it's, you know, strength and conditioning. I think a lot of coaches that listen might just be doing like their practices.
So just for clarification, an average rally is 7.8 seconds. That means nothing within the context. So volleyball coaches, what that means is that's about the ball crossing the net twice. Somebody serves it over, that team doesn't score. Somebody defends, transitions, scores. That's about 8 seconds. Every time the ball crosses, about another 4 seconds. So if it goes to kind of three, you know, serve receive team, then defense, then back to serve receive team, that's going to be, you know, about an 11 to 12 second rally. So there's some context. But like the number of jumps and swings in a match, and are you correlating that to what you're doing in practice? I've definitely had practices in my past when I didn't know this stuff where I'm like, hey, we're going to do repeat, you know, attack, transition, attack, transition, attack, transition. Let's keep in mind that, you know, by position, like outsides, if you're in a 5-set match, outsides are jumping 100 times and they'll have 50 swings, 60 swings in a 5-set match. If you're getting that in a 10-minute drill and then you multiply that out across a 2-hour practice because we go intense and we get our work in and that sort of thing, I mean, it's way off the mark. That's not match relevant.
Well, and then you don't get to look at the kid and call her soft when she tears her ACL, when she just played 11 matches in one practice.
And like, so I'll touch on club for just a quick minute because I'm going to hand this over to Alex. But the idea in club that, hey, as a club, we're going to train intense when your son or daughter comes here. We're going to have 2-3 hour practices and we're going to get it, you know. And each drill is going to be up tempo and we're going to get their reps, but are those reps in line with what they're going to see in a match? And then they go and they play this absolutely insane number of games over a weekend that our girls, or I mean, cause I coach women, but that they would never face, in terms of volume. And then you know what they do the next week? They do the same thing. And I'll ask Alex this, would it not be a nightmare for you, Alex, if I said, hey, I'm going to play 12 matches this weekend. I'm also going to have 2 to 3 hour practices. And I'm always going to have those practice. I will always have those practices, whether we play on the weekend or not. You'd be like, wait, what?
Mm-hmm. Wow. I lived it for 2 years.
You're describing every club team right now.
Yeah. Alex's resignation paper will be on your table.
Yep. I mean,
And that shouldn't serve as an indictment of people in the club world. It should serve as just a warning marker of, listen, we're at the college level, we're getting more and more athletes who come to us injured or just a little bit in disrepair. Mm-hmm. And it's because, hey, if you have a big match weekend, that's fine. Like, that's the way the club world works. Nobody cares about that. But let's maybe give them minimum 2 days off. They should not be back in the gym Monday or Tuesday for a 3-hour practice with a little lift and a conditioning set. That should not be happening. That's where the injury occurs. And this, by the way, again, it's said in this paper, if you want to look at this sort of, but this is not our opinion. This is a well-researched fact. It's not something that, well, Tim and Alex from William and Mary, they just think that. No, it's highly doubtable that athletes recover in 24 hours, much less 40, 48 after you play 4 matches. But,
So having come from the club space, it's interesting to me that the first thing anybody ever asked me was how high a girl jump, and then they run practices the way that they do. And they'll have 300, 400 maximal jumps in a practice in short order and all of that. So it's like, it's the club thing can happen because a lot of people do come out of it okay at the end of it somehow. It's a miracle. But like, I think what they can do better is if, because they need to actually scale up to those loads, because they, the amount of load that a club athlete will face over the course of a qualifier weekend is so much higher than college. But you can't start there. That doesn't mean that you get to start higher. It just means that you need to build up higher eventually. So having that time, but just because you have 2 hours doesn't mean you need to use the whole thing. You can get two sets worth. Say if you're gonna, if you want to speak in terms of volleyball, your first week back, do a two-set simulated game. Do a three-set, four-set, five-set, and build up over weeks. It's still limiting the amount of risk that they're exposed to. But you can do lighter things like serve and pass. You don't need to do nonstop continuation for 35 minutes just because they're practicing hard. And that's what they do. But what's baffling to me in the club space was just like the one hand, how high are they jumping? Are they getting better? And then they go out to practice and they do things that directly interfere with their ability to learn to jump better because they're jumping too much. And then they're jumping fatigued. So they're getting 1,000 reps jumping like crap. People adapt to what that they're exposed to stress-wise. In the paper, we mentioned how people adapt to things. So you, in the high-low model, say you have a high day, take a low day off, and you bounce back. So if you apply a stress to something, the body's going to try to adapt to that thing. So if you tell it that it's got to jump 500 times in a day, it's going to try to find a way to jump 500 times in a day. And how high that's going to be able to jump is not going to be nearly as high. But then at the same time, in the sport, we value kids that jump high. So designing practices and doing things that will lead to kids jumping high in the specific means. So in this case, being able to approach jump, whatever, whether it's a slide or outside, here's approach jump, high, fast, and effectively, and giving them enough rest to be able to repeat that is key for their development. So you don't ruin a Ferrari. You don't ruin a super bouncy kid that she's looks like she's 110 pounds, but she hits the ground and energy comes from somewhere and she's 30 inches in the air versus somebody who's got a lot of meat on their quads and needs to propel themselves up more with muscle. So they're not more of a Super Bowl. So using these things helps structure practice and make the specific thing drive you to what you want, being kids that jump high instead of kids that can brush the bottom of a basketball net 100 times.
Tim, question for you. I guess two-part question. Do you tell your kids at practice that, hey, today's a high day and, hey, today's a low day? Or do you just kind of roll with practice and they just go out and compete in whatever we're doing for that specific day?
We're really transparent. We tell them exactly what the week is going to look like. So we'll say, hey, Monday's off. Tuesday is a serve and pass. Wednesday, we're going to have a full 2 hours. It's going to be go from the minute the whistle blows. It's going to be on. Thursday, we're going to cool it off. Friday, we'll ramp up. Saturday, we'll play. And I actually wrote that down while Alex was talking, because I think there's an idea that on a low day, even if it's low volume, like 30 minutes serve and pass, okay, our athletes are going to be distracted. You know, they won't be engaged. And that's not the case. If you tell them, listen, this is better for you long-term for your health, you're going to be more explosive, you're going to play better, you're going to play like the self that you envision because you're taking this time to recover. And then you tell them, let's be 30 minutes dialed in, focused, get better at some technical skill work, and then we'll call it a day. Guess what? They're like, okay, cool. Like, I'm have time to maybe go talk to a friend and maybe do that homework or meet that group research project, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, relax with my family or have dinner with my family rather than, you know, travel home. I mean, there's these things, you know, what a thought. So no, it could be unique to William and Mary that those girls just happen to be dialed in for that 30 minute serve and pass. But I think if you tell them the why behind it, they're going to buy in.
And that was my second question, was just because it's a low day in terms of physical stress you're putting on their body, is it a low intensity day? And I guess the answer is specifically no. We're still like, if we're going to serve and pass, we're going to serve well, we're going to pass well. It's just going to be a low dose.
Well, it's probably going to be low intensity too. So rather than me just staying on the end line and go ball in, ball in, ball in, ball in, it's going to be like ball in, reset at the time that you'd normally reset, take 12 seconds between those, snap in another ball. Make sure our comms are good. Make sure our alignment is good. Make sure we know who our passing outside is. Make sure we know who's passing short. Make sure the setter gets back into what rotation they're in. Make sure the servers are taking their time and focusing on their objective. Make sure the coaches are communicating anything that needs to be different. Like, that can be really effective.
And I'm sorry, I worded that question poorly. It's low intensity, lower intensity, but it's still like, we're still giving a crap about what we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like we show up to the gym, whack a couple balls, fart some passes, generally near maybe a setter.
We're not farting around for 30 minutes. It's like, and you know, there's still the expectation that if you're not crisp, like, there's still consequences for that. That doesn't mean run. Okay. Like, the consequences here means like, hey, how about you need to go take five over there? Like, are you not good to go? Like, you can just leave the gym. Like, that's cool with me. Like, I don't know if you want to train or not. But anyways, yeah, I mean, the intensity means like, you're still dialed into what you're doing. There still needs to be a full investment in your attention to detail. And we make that perfectly clear, to be honest, you know, that it has to be like that. And some of that comes with, are you recruiting kids who want to be there and they have that expectation of themselves? And because some athletes will be like, dude, this is awesome. I'm not going to do anything today. So that matters. There is some personal discrepancies just from personality. But yeah, I think that answers your question.
I was going, this maybe this is for Alex. The podcast is for the everyday coach. It's for everybody, but you know, I want it to be able, people to be able to listen to it and kind of understand. Did you just make fun of me, Pat? Oh, I thought you were making fun of me of saying everybody in the entire world.
I think he was.
I think he was too. That's pretty typical. Oh gosh. So one of the things that I would find challenging is being able to kind of track some of this stuff at a more collegiate, you know, it's easier, I feel like, you know, for a collegiate program to have, you know, strength and conditioning support and have a coach that's kind of monitoring these things. But, you know, I think about some of my coaching friends that have, you know, a bunch of little 14-year-olds running around, and I still think these things are important. The way I was thinking, maybe you could tell me if this is kind of on the right track, is, you know, maybe you track the number of jumps in like one drill, not the whole practice, just one drill, like start off like really easy. You do the RP, the rate of perceived exertion, you know, you get a number just to gauge, like, you don't have to put in a giant spreadsheet and do all this math. You just kind of use it as like a personal gauge of, are your practices kind of in line with where you should be training appropriately?
Mm-hmm. So if I was to start and not have any, the tracking jumps might be tough to do if you don't have a lot of eyes in your gym. So if it's one or two of you against a group of kids, I would start with the internal load and the rate of perceived exertion and tracking that for each individual kid, because you only need to take that once. You can take that at the end of practice. And then that's just, so the rate of perceived exertion is on a scale of 1 to 10, how difficult practice was, or whatever the session that you just did was. So a 1 was they stood by the ref stand and they handed balls to the coach, and a 10 is it was the hardest practice they've ever participated in. Multiply that by the duration in minutes, and that is your load for the day. And then you can just track that number over time. We have internal load buildouts in the paper as well. So in this case, it's a question at the end of practice that you ask them individually or have them text it to you individually so they don't influence each other. So if it is one downside of this is that if one athlete hears that it's a 7 and they think it was a 10, but they don't want to be soft, then they're going to say it was a 7. So having some sort of private, semi-private thing, there's a text message, or we use Google Sheets in our case because we have a great data science person that's put together some dashboards for us. But collecting that, how hard it was on a scale of 1 to 10 by the time and minutes of practice was, gives you the number, and then tracking that over time. So I would just start with internal load. If I was 17-year-old me in a gym, that's, and hopefully they can multiply.
Let's say you were coaching the strangest volleyball team at Ohio State when you're on the men's side, and I'm on the team and Bo Jackson's on the team, and we are playing two incredibly different athletes.
I'm sorry.
Because Bo is a human bicep and I am not. how do you Yeah, just as an example, I'm a regular human being, and Bo is definitively not a regular human being. How do you design a practice to make sure that I'm getting pushed where I'm a doughy 5'11" and you have some super athlete and making sure, like, because, like, on one hand, you could challenge Bo, and that's going to probably kill the rest of your team. But if you are pushing me, there's no way that this guy is even in the, like, breaking a sweat.
So I think there's two
things. Or is that okay, I guess?
It is rate of perceived exertion. So your doughy self may be going as hard as possible, and it just doesn't look good. Whereas Bo Jackson goes as hard as possible and he's cleaning up and he's making you act a fool. And so both of those would be nines on the RPE scale because you're going hard. It just doesn't look good. And he's going hard. It just looks awesome. But I think what you're referring to is actually something that happened to us this past spring even. And we play 6-on-6. And at the end of the like a wash drill, you know, I'm entering down balls or something like that. And our liberos would rate practice like a 4 or a 5. Like, it just wasn't that hard. And our front row players were at like a 7 or an 8. And I thought, okay, I'm not challenging them. I need to change my drill design. So you might have a different position from Bo in this instance, and I might need to start entering in down balls or, you know, a really tough dig or a tip or a chase ball to a libero to make them work a little bit harder to account for, you know, making practice intense. Or, if it's the same position group and it's not as hard, it could just be two different personalities. And that person, you know, at the end of the day, either you could consider something like, I think most coaches would think, okay, that person needs extra work, or they just need to be challenged with the entry of a ball or how long maybe the rally goes. I don't know. And Alex, you can probably extrapolate on that. But I think that at the end of the day, you're going to see the biggest differences between position groups. And that usually is reflected in your drill design and whether you're challenging everybody across the board. And so some drills will even say, we know it's going to be tough on the jumpers. So this next drill, we're going to just maybe pummel the back row and just make them work like dogs, you know, and they're going to really have to go for everything. And at the end of the practice, they both rated a 7 at that point.
So as far as, I mean, the RPE goes, that is, if Bo is cleaning shop and it's a 9 and he's jumping as high as he can and it's move fast, then that's still going to be a 9. As far as something to push the upper level person further, I would say that Bo Jackson, if given the opportunity to play a volleyball game's worth of approach jumps, is going to be pretty fried after that, because the way that intensity works, the higher that the intensity is, the deeper the rut will be after the fact. So if Usain Bolt running 100 meters at his top speed is going to fry his nervous system more than my Division III body has ever experienced in my entire life. So if you're driving a Ferrari and it goes full speed, the amount of burnout is going to be much higher than a mule trying to go top speed, if that makes sense. So he'll, even though he's only jumping 50 times and he's fine in the moment because he's aerobically fit enough to turn it over, keep coming back, ask him how he's feeling tomorrow, because he might be feeling a lot worse than your frumpy mule that's playing right alongside of him. So managing that training load is still something that needs to be done. And it's just an understanding that is like, all right, you're looking great. We're going to stick with the plan because the plan is making you feel good and helping you perform at this level. And we'll keep gradually improving it rather than just like, oh, you can do more, so we're going to do more. And then finding out that they're not actually ready to do more.
And with that, I have, I guess, two questions, and I don't know which order they make sense in. I guess I'll start with Alex. I believe the most load, the heaviest load you can put on an athlete in a volleyball practice would be jumping, correct?
I'd agree.
Like a single
maximal. A 6-on-6 game with a maximal jump and a maximal swing would be the highest, because the cognitive input of dealing with 6 other players on the other side of the net, timing things out with your setter, getting up as high in the air as you can, and then trying to put as much force into the ball as possible. So that's the most violent volleyball thing I can think of offhand.
Okay. And then do you have, I don't know if you have data for it, because I was thinking as Tim, you explained that the liberos were feeling like, hey, this is kind of a four. You know, we're not really getting a whole lot out of this kind of thing. Do you guys have any data on what hitting the floor does to the body? And like, because let's face it, libero, probably not jumping very much, but it's not like they don't take abuse. I mean, they're going to the floor digging a bunch. Is there any data that kind of shows, okay, jumping as high as you can, then landing is a stress on the body. Is there any way to weigh out what going to the floor does to a libero?
I would say if you'll find out through the RPEs, but having not coached a high level practice before, the highest level I've coached is bad eighth graders. Going to the floor is a lot. Going to the floor and getting back up over and over again is going to be a lot more stressful than having a ball hit slightly to your left and slightly to your right. And trying to, I can think of a high level libero that we had at Northern Lights who just reading the other team would take 1,000 steps because she was trying to read everything. So the cognitive load that the libero has to go through is a lot higher than some of the other positions as well, because they need to position themselves in response to what the other team's doing. So I would say that going to the floor is probably having to read all of that and then going to the floor and get the ball is probably the hardest thing that they have to do, as well as holding good defensive positions for an extended period of time. Like in a 40-second rally, they're not going to be just standing straight up at any point. So they're going to be moving around, repositioning themselves in a athletic position, which has a metabolic cost. So it's not going to be the same stress as jumping as high as possible, similar to a high jumper or hitting a ball as hard as possible like a pitcher, but holding that position, which I've called back row players like offensive linemen before, and they didn't really take good credit to that, but they sit positions and shuffle around. So
I don't see why.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why a 16-year-old girl who's 5 feet tall and 18 pounds, why she wouldn't want to be referred to as one of the dancing bears of the NFL.
Most athletic people out there.
Yeah.
You can at me.
Tim, you guys obviously, instead of grooving balls at them, now made them work harder, and that's part of their load. You know, that's how you raise their load instead of grooving it at them and making it easy.
Yeah.
You just made their load harder.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of drills, and you know this, they enter in with like a simple free ball. You know, you can change that pretty quickly just to make sure that the libero is going. And I don't think that we have data on what diving and impact is, but man, I would hope that something like this, like the project that we worked on, hopefully compels people to start to look at the game in a way that says, how do we measure that? And how do we look at what that means for liberos? Because we don't, and it's a big part of the game, because when a libero is moving full speed and diving after some of these balls and they're just bang, their whole body hits the ground and you see some of these gnarly bruises that they come back with and they're suddenly like, hey coach, I need an arm sleeve. I'm like, yeah, look at that thing. I actually think I might even have a picture on my Instagram. One of our liberos last year just had like the sickest like 5-inch bruise across her elbow. And like, I don't know how to measure that, but I would hope that somebody can get on top of that.
There is discussion in football about collision conditioning and using grappling and those sorts of things. So there's a big metabolic cost to collision. It's just not as measured out as say jumping at this venture.
Look at me on the cutting edge.
Wow. Who would have known? Gosh.
I'm not even getting paid for this.
Yeah, wow.
No one is.
Oh, no, Sarah, you're getting $2 per ad.
No. I'm getting like, I think it's $15 per like 1,000 listens or something, or like 1,000 impacts. I think it took me a while to break a dollar. I think I'm at $4 right now. And this is, I have 8 episodes posted. I think I have $4.23. So
if you can send me the 8 cents that I'm going to earn you.
Yeah, I will. Where would you like me to write the check out?
I was going to say, I'm going to do the tax paperwork after this.
I'm going to send you a W-9 and report it to the IRS, just so you know.
I like how you haven't even earned 3 toonies in Canada. So, yeah. So I guess I'll leave it to Alex. If there's one thing you hope a listener takes into their gym from the strength side, Like, what's your one? Like, what's your one big thing?
I guess it would be that as a coach, your role, you are prescribing exercises, regardless of if you decide to do physical fitness activities in your practice plan or not. The fact that you're prescribing approach jumps and drills and activities, they're exercises that cost something. So going in and having a measured plan for how much of those that you're going to use is to the benefit of you if you like winning, and to the benefit of your athletes if you want, like, to keep them healthy, which play hand in hand. So having a measured approach to what you do as a coach and getting past, we're going to do this thing for 5 minutes. Well, how long are they going to be able to rest in between? How many times are they going to do it? Just getting to that level and understanding that there's a cost and they should recover from that after the fact is putting you ahead of most.
Alex, you said the most amazing thing right now, and I wrote it down, and I'm going to remember this for the rest of my life now. As a coach, you are prescribing physical activity. Like, I don't think coaches really think about that. Like, you literally are having such a huge impact on people's, like, young kids' physical development. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I don't think a lot of coaches, you know, they care a lot about the drills, which are really important, but man, that's very good. I like that.
Same question to you, Tim.
Twofold. One, the fact that Alex and I are on here together, not everybody has a strength coach, but I implore anybody who does, collaborate with them. If you guys aren't partnerships in making it safer for your athletes and boosting the performance for your athletes, it's a disservice. I mean, Alex is a goldmine of information that I'm lucky enough to just try and mine every day, but it's important that we do that together. But I think if there was any one thing that any coach across the country could take, it'd be volleyball at this point in time in the past 10 years has surpassed girls basketball as the most played junior girls sport. The level of athlete that we're receiving at the club level, at the juniors level, is changing. And the athlete that we're working with at the college level is changing. And we need to professionalize our approach to training and our approach to scheduling and all this stuff in a way that's commensurate with the quality and caliber of athlete that we're seeing. And we're not talking about people who happen to start playing both sports. We're saying girls are leaving basketball to come to volleyball. That's a big distinguishing point, because that means that really and truly we're getting some of the most elite female talent in our gyms. And if we're not thinking about how do we rise the level in our gym, elevate the level in our gym, you know, to keep that consistent and to keep, you know, they have an expectation that they want to train to be the best. And this is just part of it, is scientific and evidence-based practice.
Another profound thought. I love it that, you know, we were just talking about the not doing things the way that we used to do, the way they've always been done. And you're exactly right that the level of play is changing. The sort of kids that I'm coaching right now are nowhere near the kids that I played with when I was playing back in the day. And I think the professionalizing, like, our approach it's so important for us to reach out to strength and conditioning professionals or people that have, you know, like, peers and colleagues that maybe know a little bit more or even a little less, like, getting another perspective on things. I mean, this is not your let's just drill the hell out of them sort of, you know, and just make them jump a bunch of times and they're going to be fine. Like, this is definitely a different breed of athlete. And I think we're doing a disservice to our sport if we don't kind of look at, you know, how we're prescribing physical activity and we are, we need to professionalize our approach. Like, I think those are so, so important. And I love you too. And I want you to be my friends. So.
Hey, thank you guys for having us on. This is awesome being here with you guys.
If people are interested in trying to find the things that we've based this on, Tim Gabbett is the author behind a lot of the research articles regarding training load. And Carl Foster is another one regarding the high-low model, or in his case, the easy-hard model. And Charlie Francis are names to look into.
We could do it on my website too, if you really want, if you want to host. I could put it on the podcast website. So.
So what you're saying is this is a Dig and Swing exclusive.
It is an exclusive. Exclusive breaking news.
That's hot. Take that.
Good job, Pat.
Just doing this for free, guys. Just doing this for
free. I think we all are.
You should see when I try. So, anyway, thank you both. I appreciate it.
You guys are awesome. This was so cool.
The privilege is all ours. Thank you, seriously, for taking as much time as you did and trying to work your way through that, paper to begin with, and just coming up with such great questions. And, hopefully this conversation continues to move us forward, and just, real privilege to be on here. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks again, guys. Pat, you going to sign out and say bye?
No.
5 minutes? No? Okay.
I'm above that now.